You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello, Heat Nation. You're listening to Locked On Heat, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Thank you for subscribing on Apple and Google Podcasts, Spotify, or in the Himalaya. My name is David Arell. Today's show is brought to you by Built Bar, the best tasting protein bar I've ever had. Today's show is about, well, the biggest what-ifs in Miami Heat franchise history. The third part of a series for this week. We've been exploring some of the biggest questions, the unanswered questions in franchise history. What if scenarios that might have taken place if a player hadn't gotten hurt? I discussed Chris Bosh if he had never developed blood clots during the 2015 season, whether or not he might have been able to impact the Heat and possibly help propel them into a championship run. I talked about a number of different things regarding the Heat and some scenarios there, including whether or not they had been able to trade for Hakeem Olajuwon, the Hall of Fame player, back in 1992. It would have been a fantastic matchup seeing him in the Southeast Division going up against an interstate rival in Shaquille O'Neal, who had been drafted that same summer. Either way, great shows. Make sure you check them out. The responses I've gotten have been pretty positive, so it seems like everybody's enjoying those. And I'll continue that today when I discuss one of the biggest questions from 2000, which is, what if the Miami Heat had signed Tracy McGrady? I'll be honest with you, I had absolutely forgotten or perhaps even completely overlooked that this was a potential scenario there. Back in 2000, Tracy McGrady was a young player, had been drafted right out of high school by the Toronto Raptors, joined his cousin Vince Carter, and was starting to form a very potent duo along with the high-scoring Carter. They were two guys that could score. They were both from the Orlando area, and they were able to score at a high level. Obviously, Tracy McGrady wound up becoming a Hall of Fame-level scorer and player. He spent time with Orlando, Houston, and a bunch of other teams towards the tail end of his career. But at that point in time, he was a young player on his way to a really impressive Hall of Fame-level peak, and so he entered free agency knowing that he did not want to play for the Toronto Raptors. And so in the years since, he's discussed his decision to leave the Toronto Raptors, and he said that he would never have left Toronto if he could go and replay it again. Another what if, a personal what if for McGrady. But he actually, in 2000, joined the Orlando Magic, the hometown team. But there was a brief moment there during that summer of 2000 where he actually was back and forth between the Magic and Miami. In fact, Brian Windhorst told a story about this a few years ago when he appeared on Bill Simmons' podcast with The Ringer, and he mentioned the recruitment process for Tracy McGrady. This is a direct quote from Windhorst on Simmons' pod. They bring him down on a private jet, meaning McGrady, and they bring him to Alonzo Mourning's house on the same day, and they have drinks and they hang out, and you know Zoe was like one of the coolest guys in the league. He still is one of the coolest guys in the league. So they're chilling at Zoe's house, and all of a sudden the speedboat pulls up, and Zoe says, "Hey Tracy, let's go for a ride." They get into the speedboat, they hit go, and the speedboat goes 80 miles an hour across Biscayne Bay, zapping by the arena, downtown Miami. It's beautiful. It pulls into Pat Riley's house down the cove, and Riley's standing there holding a max contract offer. So that's probably one of, I don't know how true this is. I mean, Windhorst got some reporting. I'm sure he's probably dug into the entire scenario there. But that sounds like possibly one of the coolest recruitment pitches I've ever heard. For a young player like McGrady to be able to be wined and dined by not just a player like Alonzo Mourning, who was a multi-time All-Star, but of course one of the greatest coaches, general managers in the league at Riley, who was still coaching the team at that point in time. I think that must have been so impressive and probably why he was going back and forth between the Magic and the Heat. But unfortunately, whereas it seemed like that pitch was going to cement McGrady joining the Heat, he wound up choosing the Magic instead. He had a Hall of Fame level career where he was scoring almost 20 points per game over the course of his career. In his first year with the Orlando Magic, he actually averaged 27 points per game. He actually averaged 32 points per game during the 2002-2003 season. So he was well on his way to being one of the most potent scorers, perhaps in NBA history. A guy who could do it all at 6'8". He could shoot from long range. He was a slasher, not a very good defender. I'll be 100% honest with you. A decent playmaker. He had the ball in his hands a lot, and he was able to make plays for others because he commanded so much respect, pulling double teams, triple teams on occasion, and so he was able to find cutting teammates and things of that sort. And the decision to join the Magic made a lot of sense. They had just signed Grant Hill. He had left the Detroit Pistons as a free agent. They were that close, another what-if scenario for the Orlando Magic, that they were this close to signing a big three of their own by pulling in Tim Duncan. Unfortunately for the Magic, the Duncan chose to rejoin the San Antonio Spurs instead. Of course, the only team which he played for during his Hall of Fame career. And so McGrady and Hill were paired together there as the future of the Magic. Hill wound up having a number of foot injuries, ankle injuries specifically, that kept him out from being the kind of impact player that he had been with Detroit, or also would have been a very potent duo on their own there. The question here then comes from what would have happened if he had stayed with Miami. Well, going back to 2000 and some of the reporting that took place there, it seemed like the best option for Miami would have been to engage in a sign-and-trade agreement in order to pull McGrady into the franchise. And so the proposed deal, at least one that had been circulating there, was a three-player agreement that would have sent McGrady to Miami after signing a contract with the Raptors, and P.J. Brown and second-year guard Anthony Carter, quote from the Sun Sentinel, a free agent the Raptors are strongly pursuing, end quote, in exchange for McGrady. You could have signed McGrady, one of the best shooting forwards, guards in NBA history, in exchange for P.J. Brown and Anthony Carter. Now, I love AC. He's a great coach. He was a fine player during his tenure in Miami. He had a good career for a guy like him. And I love P.J. Brown and his impact here. One of my best memories from my early fandom of the Heat was watching him flip Charlie Ward, just because I hate FSU as well as the New York Knicks. And so that was a great thing for me to see all in one there. And of course, I always thought that Charlie Ward was particularly dirty towards the Heat. But either way, that's a whole other story there. But in exchange for P.J. Brown and Anthony Carter, you get McGrady. That is unbelievable. I can't even wrap my mind around how little it would have taken to pry him out there. That's all it would have taken. If you go back to that 1999-2000 roster for Miami, you obviously had Alonzo Mourning. You had Tim Hardaway there, who was an all-star form himself. You had Jamal Mashburn on this team. You could have kept McGrady as a two, maybe even bring Mashburn off the bench as a high-potent wing scorer. But you could have kept him there. Dan Majerle retires after that season, after the end of the 99-2000 season. But you could have had another similarly great. Maybe you could bring Majerle back there, or you can add somebody else. They had added Bruce Bowen on that team as well. So he was another guy who was able to provide some scoring from the perimeter, as well as some incredible perimeter defense. So it was a very, very good team there. And unfortunately, once the decision for McGrady not to sign in Miami, it changed the course of franchise history there. Miami wound up instead trying to attract Eddie Jones from the Charlotte Hornets. He wound up signing with Charlotte and then being traded to Miami. They had also brought in Brian Grant as a free agent, who was with the Portland Trailblazers, or it may have been the Sacramento Kings. I think it's the Blazers at that point. He started his career off with the Kings and eventually played with the Blazers. So he joined Miami as a free agent there. And then Miami acquired Eddie Jones by trading Jamal Mashburn along with P.J. Brown, not signing Anthony Carter there. Oh, no, I'm sorry. They did re-sign Anthony Carter as a free agent for less money, obviously, even though he was apparently a coveted point guard at that point. They wind up having Anthony Mason on the roster in exchange, who came in the deal with Charlotte. So Anthony Mason was with the Charlotte Hornets. Eddie Jones signed with the Charlotte Hornets and then was traded to Miami. And then they built a team around Alonzo, Tim Hardaway, Eddie Jones, Anthony Mason, and Brian Grant. Or at least that was the proposed plan. Unfortunately, Alonzo Mourning wound up developing a kidney disease that summer that wound up keeping the team out of contention in the foreseeable future. And of course, wound up sending Alonzo out of Miami in just a few years. I'll talk about in the next segment about what would have happened if maybe the team had stayed intact, and what would have continued to happen if McGrady had chosen to sign with the Miami Heat. You're listening to Locked On Heat. All right, I've been talking to you about Built Bar, the best-tasting protein bar that I've ever had, and I'll continue to do so because I don't always like the products that we endorse as a network, but I really do strongly believe in Built Bar as a protein bar. It's a great snack. It gives you all the nutrients you're looking for. Some protein bars just don't taste very good. The ones that do aren't particularly good for you. I keep reiterating that, but it's something I strongly learned over the course of my life. But Built Bars taste like a candy bar, and they've got the nutrients you're looking for. They're low calorie, they're low sugar, they're high protein, high fiber. 16 flavors to choose from. Everybody around the network has a favorite that they love. I personally prefer the banana chocolate cream. I'm sure you'll find one that you like as well. But they are easy to choose. They taste awesome. They're good for you. And right now, if you go to BuiltBar.com, use the promo code LOCKEDON. That's one word, LOCKEDON. You'll get $10 off your first order. Go to BuiltBar.com, use the promo code LOCKEDON for $10 off. It's a great tasting protein bar. You won't be disappointed, and it's good for you too. What if Dion Waiters had stayed healthy? One of you wants to know what might have happened if Dion Waiters had never injured his ankle in 2017. It's an interesting question there. I'll answer that in the next segment. But this time, I'll be continuing to talk a little bit more about what would have happened if Tracy McGrady had signed with the Heat in 2000. That was a huge summer for Miami. They wound up overhauling a roster that could just never get past the New York Knicks. Obviously, they had only advanced past the Knicks just once during a four-year stretch where they met the Knicks every year in the playoffs. The Knicks would wind up pulling off one of the ultimate upsets in NBA history as an eighth seed, knocking off the one seed Miami after the Chicago Bulls had finished their second three-peat in 1998. Michael Jordan retired a second time. There was a lockout there, and it completely changed the whole course of the NBA. Miami, unable to capitalize, built around Alonzo Mourning and Tim Hardaway, and of course, Jamal Mashburn, Clarence Weatherspoon, Dan Marley, Bruce Bowen, so many other players that were contributors during that great era in Heat history. Great teams, but facing a mirror image of themselves in the New York Knicks, unfortunately, only able to, like I said, get past them the once in their four respective playoff battles. Adding McGrady in 2000 might have changed all that. Again, a high potent scorer entering his peak. His career was somewhat derailed by back injuries, and again, he was never quite the defensive player that fit into typical Miami schemes, but none of that seems like it matters when you add a scorer, a guy who could bring the ball up, who commands so much respect on offense, who could pass out of double teams and create opportunities for others. If you think about that roster, here's a look at what the roster looked like in 2000 and 2001. Again, the trade for McGrady, just for Anthony Carter and P.J. Brown in exchange for Tracy McGrady. They already had Bruce Bowen on the roster. Anthony Carter's gone. Cedric Ceballos was brought in as a backup wing player, a guy who could score a little bit. You have Tim Hardaway on the roster. You have Dan Marley, who played another year there in 2000. You have Anthony Mason. Well, he was acquired from the Charlotte Hornets trade, so that wouldn't have worked out. But Alonzo Mourning was on the roster as well. That is just a fantastic lineup. And you also have, A.C. Green, Ricky Davis, Dwayne Coswell, a number of guys who contribute there. But your core is Tracy McGrady, Tim Hardaway, and Alonzo Mourning. I can't see who would have been able to get past the Heat at that point in time. With that kind of defensive core, with Mourning, Bowen, Marley, other guys that could contribute at that point, and then you have such incredibly potent scoring offense, it just boggles the mind to think that, Miami could have had a title even sooner than 2006. In 2000, I think about the 2000-2001 team that represented the Eastern Conference in the finals was the Philadelphia 76ers. And Allen Iverson was entering MVP form, and he was, of course, a scorer in his own right, small-type player. They also acquired Dikembe Mutombo midway through that season in a trade with the Atlanta Hawks. A good team, one that was going to face the Los Angeles Lakers for the first of their three-peat. It could have been the matchup of a lifetime. Alonzo facing Shaquille O'Neal, Tim Hardaway going up against Derek Fisher, Tracy McGrady going up against Kobe Bryant. That would have been such a tantalizing opportunity to go up against the Lakers. Who knows if the Lakers wind up pulling off the three-peat there. So let's take a step back, because you can start already building. Unfortunately, what really happened is that Alonzo Mourning winds up getting hurt. He does develop his kidney disease that wound up keeping him out for most of that 2000-2001 season. He only wound up playing 13 regular season games. He started three, was coming off the bench for most of those, and then kind of changed the way the team played dramatically. If you recall what happened, it was really unfortunate. Anthony Mason had played for Pat Riley in New York, and then he was eventually traded to the Charlotte Hornets, and he came to Miami in the trade that brought Eddie Jones to Miami as well. And Mason really embrace his role there. He kind of fit in perfectly. Brian Grant wind up slotting into a very small size center who had a nice mid-range game. Mason was more of a bulky 3-4, a guy who could defend number of players. He was undersized at 6'7". That might have been a little generous, but he was strong enough to kind of hold his own against centers and things of that sort. He was just a very versatile player. And then he could make plays for others. He was a good passer, good interior presence with a nice low post game. And he played really, really well in his one season in Miami. He plays 80 games, started all 80 of those. And then Alonzo came back, and all of a sudden the offense kind of shifted dramatically. It was no longer going through Mason, and Alonzo kind of took a lot of the shine away from Mason. Mason was pretty upset about that. They just fell apart completely in the playoffs, and then, of course, the next couple of years were just a blur when you really didn't have Alonzo Mourning at full strength, and he was clearly weak and not necessarily the player he had been earlier in his career in Miami. And then he would wind up leaving Miami as a free agent in 2003, signing a deal with the New Jersey Nets. Just a sorry end to what had been a great career and a great partnership between Alonzo, Pat Riley, and the Miami Heat. So if you get McGrady there, again, you're looking at a team that has Hardaway, McGrady, Mashburn, because you don't have to trade him. Heck, maybe you even still pull off that trade. Maybe you do something different. I don't know. I mean, you could have traded Bruce Bowen and Jamal Mashburn for Eddie Jones, and maybe that would have been a better fit there, where you have Jones at the two, Hardaway at the one, McGrady playing a three, and then you find somebody to play the four. I mean, you could still theoretically sign Brian Grant. I guess you don't have that money. But, you know, maybe you could find somebody else to slot in there at the four to play alongside Alonzo Mourning. Either way, you've got four really, really good players, four potential Hall of Famers there. Eddie Jones wound up not really fulfilling the expectations that were brought with him when he came from Charlotte to Miami. But either way, he was a really solid player for most of his career in Los Angeles and Charlotte and in Miami, kind of overlooked in the history books there. But that was such a great team. Hardaway bringing the ball up, finding McGrady cutting there. Who would have been able to stop that incredible size and skill, his athleticism? Maybe McGrady doesn't become the primary scorer the way he was in Orlando, but maybe that helps his back too. Maybe Miami's training staff, Ron Culp, one of the greatest trainers in Heat history, but also one of the great trainers in NBA history, might have been able to find the problem there. Maybe they would have been able to correct it. Maybe he doesn't wind up having the kind of recurring back issues that impaired him so much throughout the rest of his career. Just a great what if there, because honestly, it seems like it would have been such a great team. They would have probably knocked off the Knicks, gone past Iverson and the 76ers. I can't think of any other teams that were really competitive at that point in time. To be honest with you, they would have at the very least competed for a title. Now, would it have been enough to get past the Los Angeles Lakers? You know, the Shaquille O'Neal thing is an issue, because you would have had to go through Mourning, again, assuming that Mourning is at full strength. If he had been able to hold his own against Shaq, at least that would have limited him somewhat. I don't think Kobe would have become Kobe. I think he would have had his own problems trying to deal with McGrady. I think, again, you would have had enough offense in Miami's favor. Hardaway, clearly a better scorer than Fisher ever was as a defender. You might have been able to at least steal one, maybe two of those titles. If you recall, the Lakers wound up making the finals 4 times out of 5 years. Only one time did they actually lose to the San Antonio Spurs, and then the Spurs wound up advancing to the finals and beat the Detroit Pistons for their second title in 2003. In 2004, Shaq, Kobe, along with Karl Malone and Gary Payton, wound up advancing to the NBA Finals there. But a whole different scenario, and who knows how it would have played out with Miami. Just such a fascinating what-if there, and we'll never know for certain. Again, McGrady says he would have loved to have stayed in Toronto. He chose Orlando because it was a hometown team. But if he had stayed, he'd gone to Miami and helped compete for a title. Who knows what would have happened? Alonzo would never leave. Maybe Alonzo is not necessarily the player he was because of his kidney issues, but he's at least a contributor on defense. Trust Riley to be able to build that roster around McGrady and Hardaway and somehow continue to retool and fix it. He would have done something different. It's just an interesting what-if scenario that we'll never quite know about. But I'll talk about Dion Waiters in the next segment, talking about your great what-ifs in Heat franchise history. What if he never hurts his ankles? What does that mean for the 41-41 season, and how does that impact any future signings that Miami Heat would have done? You're listening to Locked On Heat. Thank you. listen to and subscribe to new and archived episodes of Locked On Heat on Himalaya, as well as on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. If you're in iTunes, please leave a rating and review, especially if it's a good one. Please, I know I keep asking for this. If you're annoyed by it, I apologize. But I do want to get as many of these ratings as possible. And to hear from you during the pandemic, it's a good opportunity for you to help me improve the show as much as possible. If you have criticisms, or if you have any concerns, or if you have any questions or anything about the content or any upcoming future for the show, make sure you just write in and send a review on iTunes if possible. But I'm going to move on to a question that comes in from one of our listeners. John writes in, what if Deion didn't roll his ankles? The 30-11 Heat had the second best net rating behind the 67-15 Warriors during that run. That's absolutely true. What if it was that the Heat upset the Celtics in the first round? In fact, what happened was that they wound up falling a half game short to Dwayne Wade and his Chicago Bulls, the three alphas consisting of Wade, Jimmy Butler, and Rajon Rondo, unfortunately, wind up getting to the playoff spot there, and they wound up being the eighth seed in the Eastern Conference that year. They wound up facing Boston Celtics. Maybe they could have pulled off the upset. Either way, the Bulls were looking like, the John continues, they were going to win the series until Rondo gets hurt. And then the following summer, would Gordon Hayward have chosen Miami over the Boston Celtics? Hayward was a free agent at that time from the Utah Jazz, chose the Celtics over both Utah and Miami. He loved the Miami Heat presentation, but he wanted to play for his former coach in Brad Stevens. John continues, would he never have gotten his ankle snapped and become a shell of his all-star self? Pat Riley was on record saying that if Hayward came to Miami, they would have given shorter and smaller deals to Deion and James Johnson, etc., instead of rewarding them for their play during the run. That is a fascinating question. Haven't really had a lot of time to think about that, but there's many ways of looking at this. From a personal perspective, or at least a very limited one, if Deion doesn't roll his ankles, well, his career in Miami is very, very different. I really do believe that the version of Deion that we saw during the 41-41 season when he was healthy was the best version of Deion, and the version that we would have kept if his injury never took place. As I've mentioned many times before, his injury happens. He's forced to play on it. The Heat, being somewhat, well, let's just say unforgiving when it comes to injuries, force him onto the floor a little bit sooner. Don't let him have surgery, or rather they recommend that he not have surgery because that takes time away. They, in fact, reward him with a long-term contract, a four-year deal. And then because he doesn't get surgery, he's never quite 100%. He comes back for the 2017-18 season at, let's say, 75% at best, claiming that he's at 100%, but also putting pressure on himself to live up to his new contract. Instead, he just winds up being in and out of the lineup, never quite 100%, like I said, and then eventually winds up electing to have surgery anyway after re-aggravating the injury. After the injury, he's out of shape, he's hurt, he takes a toll mentally and emotionally and never quite able to play the game that he loves so much, and so he gets fat, he gains weight. In the meantime, Dwayne Wade has come back to Miami, and Deion isn't there as a contributor. He's not able to help the way they expected him to when they signed into that long-term deal. But if he's never hurt, I think he takes pride in his abilities. He's able to carry this team. He had a great partnership. Something we overlook is his partnership between him and Goran Dragic. The 7-11 combination there was really, really great during that 41-41 stretch. So I think it's important to kind of, as we were very quick to bash Deion for what happened over the last year. I think a lot of that was undeserved. But at the same time, if he stays healthy and maintains that partnership there, it would have been a very fascinating scenario to see whether or not he might have been able to push them into the playoffs and been the kind of scorer that we expect him to be. Look, he's still young. He still would have been entering the peak of his career. If he's never healthy, he could have been a really good player, perhaps even an all-star level player. And maybe Dwayne comes back to Miami and he's a backup to Deion, and he's able to be the kind of contributor scorer there that everybody wanted him to be when he rejoined the team. You don't have as much pressure on Josh Richardson or Justice Winslow to be the star of the team. They're able to work their way back into the lineup and kind of complement Deion and Goran Dragic. Maybe Hassan Whiteside never develops into the knucklehead that he wound up becoming in Miami. Lots of different scenarios there. As far as Goran, going back to John's question there, I still don't think that would have been enough to convince Gordon Hayward to come to Miami. I think ultimately Miami made the ultimate presentation there. Like, Hayward Hayward said it, that the presentation was top-notch, that he was really close, that he would go back and forth, similarly to what McGrady did between Orlando and Miami. He would go back all the time. Utah was the team that drafted him. Didn't really have a connection there necessarily to the franchise or anything like that, and wasn't sure whether or not they had a high ceiling at being able to get past that Western Conference, the deep Western Conference with Golden State and all the other teams that were out there. But you know, that was the team that drafted him. He did re-sign there. If you recall, though, in restricted free agency, he actually signed an offer sheet from Michael Jordan and the Charlotte Hornets. Utah wound up matching that offer, and then he wound up staying for the first 7 years of his career in Utah. But it's not like he didn't have flirtations with other teams interested in joining, you know, during his career earlier. But in 2017, he winds up choosing Boston over Miami. And I think the ultimate factor in that decision was to join Brad Stevens, his college coach at Butler. So that wouldn't have changed any. I think the pitch to Gordon Hayward still considered that Deion would be healthy. I don't know if maybe they – I think they could have pitched it just the same way, as saying, look, Deion got hurt. That's why we didn't beat Boston. That's not – it's not that we – aren't a good team, or we're not a team that couldn't contend for a title right away if you choose to sign here, but it's just a matter of injury there. So I don't know that if they had been able to get past Boston in 2017 in the playoffs, whether that would have convinced Hayward to join here. I think ultimately he still wanted to play for Stevens, and if Miami had gone on a deep playoff run there, I think the 31-10 stretch, or the 30-11 stretch there, I think was enough to kind of show Hayward and the rest of the league how good Miami was, that it wound up not resulting in a playoff spot. I don't think it ultimately made that much of a factor, that especially in his free agency decision. Ultimately, the chance to play for Stevens trumped everything else, and that's why Hayward chose Boston. But it is a fascinating scenario to see whether or not maybe he never gets hurt. The injury was a fluke. It's not like signing in Boston is what led to the injury, although some Jazz fans viciously and wrongly were happy to see Hayward get injured in that first game of the season. If you recall, it's just a terrible injury. I don't necessarily think he's a shell of his all-star self. I think he's on a roster now that's very different. He was supposed to be the top scorer, the top contributor there, along with Kyrie Irving. Irving gets hurt in his 1 year in Boston, and then you kind of wind up having guys like Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum evolve into quality wing players, and so it's just, you didn't rely on Hayward as much. Who knows what would have happened? I mean, it's just, first of all, if you have Gordon Hayward in Miami, you probably don't get Jimmy Butler. So it's very interesting to know whether or not Jimmy would have agreed to come to Miami with Hayward already here. Is Bam the player that he is? Do you trade Hassan Whiteside, or do you see that he's much more important to build around because you know Hayward stays on this team and he's a perimeter threat that can get to the line, and so you kind of need a more of a lob presence in Whiteside, or a guy who can block shots and things of that sort. It's very fascinating, and again, just so many different small moves that take place from this one. An injury, a freak injury to Deion Waiters, could have changed the whole landscape of the NBA as we know it. Even going back a little bit more, I mean, just this close, maybe McGrady was 60-40 in favor of signing with the Magic. If they had just been 50-50 and that one recruiting pitch from Pat Riley was enough to convince him there, he comes to Miami, helps build a championship-contending team here, and who knows how it would have played out. I mean, look, the Alonzo Mourning injury, one that you couldn't have gone past anyway. It was going to take place anyway. In 2000, well, you know what? I'll save this for another episode next week when I get into a little bit more of a what-if scenario regarding Alonzo Mourning. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode and continuing my series on what-if scenarios. Special thanks to Built Bar for sponsoring today's show. Make sure to check out Rejecting the Screen with Noah Kozloff and Adam Stanko, as well as Chad Ford's Big Draft Board, now both on the Locked On Podcast Network. You can connect with me on Twitter using the hashtag AskLHeat, or email me at LockedOnHeat@gmail.com. I'm David Ramil, signing off and thanking you, as always, for your support.
Back it up, B.